Given the recent expansion of the conflict in the Middle East, we are going to expand our range of topicality, and it's not just about Gaza anymore. On today's show, we're going to start with a few web comments. The first one is by a singer named Dave Matthews, and he, I believe he's a singer. He made these comments at Willie Nelson's induction into the Hall of Fame. I'm not sure which Hall of Fame, but in any case, it's just a short commentary by one Dave Matthews. And second, we have some more web commentary. This is by a Palestinian who is not living in Palestine. He's living in the United States, I believe, somewhere. But he's well known in the field of commentary about Israel's behavior in Gaza. And he's a sort of a comedian, an actor. He's a liar. He engages people in Twitter conversations, and especially he's looking for Israeli soldiers, and he's trying to shock them basically with what they're doing to Gaza. And in getting that conversation set up, he just lies to people. So he's an actor, a very good actor, but this is not about that. This is him making commentary on the carnage that Israel inflicted on the tent camp outside of the hospital. So that's not very long. And then we're going to go into a half-hour interview that took place on a website called thelefthook.substack.com. And it is a Lebanese reporter and author. Her name is Kim Gattas. This interview took place October 13th, so this is fairly recent, and it's a very informed discussion about the situation now in Lebanon. So then following that, we'll have one of our favorite reporters from Israel named Gideon Levy. And his talk is called Israel Has Surrounded Itself with Shields. He has some very well-informed commentary. And then two more short commentary pieces by Israeli historian Ilan Pape. And they're short and sweet. Well, not sweet. Actually, they're informative. And a little 10-second, a little more web commentary, and then a thorough analysis by Max Blumenthal, reporter and investigative reporter Max Blumenthal, and again, our Israeli historian Ilan Pape. And they are going to look at the Hasbara arguments. Hasbara is the Israeli propaganda organ, and it has quite a bit of reach because it reaches out through Zionist communities throughout the world, really. So that propaganda effort is called Hasbara, and it's very active with a lot of internet, social media, the boiler room type operation. Anyway, they're going to discuss the arguments that are used in the Hasbara. So, starting here with some commentary by Dave Matthews.
The world seems upside down, where people are living in the streets hoping that they will survive the winter in the richest country in the world, and where people working full-time for a huge profitable corporations still have to get food stamps. And we have billionaires who, while competing for who can get their little rockets a tiny ways into space, or who has the biggest mega yacht, don't think they should pay taxes. While we rain bombs down on children and call it collateral damage or self-defense, it's enough for you to give up on the world. How the world could be if we could just straighten up and fly right.
So that was Dave Matthews at the induction of Willie Nelson to the Hall of Fame. Coming up next, we have a Palestinian internet activist, actually, and he's available. I'm not gonna try to say his name, but he is available at BFENDYY at Instagram.com. So BFENDYY at Instagram.com. You can see more of his work. Here he is.
The world seems upside down, where people are living in the streets hoping that they will survive the winter in the richest country in the world, and where people working full-time for a huge profitable corporations still have to get food stamps. And we have billionaires who, while competing for who can get their little rockets a tiny ways into space, or who has the biggest mega yacht, don't think they should pay taxes. While we rain bombs down on children and call it collateral damage or self-defense, it's enough for you to give up on the world. How the world could be if we could just straighten up and fly right.
I'm gonna ask a question, and I know some of you guys aren't gonna like it, but why are you guys surprised? Why are you guys in shock? What's the difference between somebody burning alive with an IV in their arm, or what's the difference between Hind, a five-year-old eating over 300 bullets that was provided by the United States? What is the difference? Why are you shocked? Why? I just want to know, why are you guys shocked? There's nothing to be shocked about. I'm not shocked. You shouldn't be shocked. And if anybody is shocked, you need to wake up. You haven't been awake. Not for the past year. Not for the past over 70 years. Wake up.
Okay. Well, now that we're awake, we're going to hear an interview with one Lebanese reporter and author named Kim Gattaz. And this took place October 13th, just a few days ago. And so there's a lot of informed commentary here about the current situation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Chai Talk with Wajahat Ali for the Left Hook Substack, where I invite a subject matter expert who is much smarter than me to tackle one big question in 30 minutes or less. And today we have all the way from Lebanon, we have the amazing reporter, analyst, author Kim Gattaz. She is an Atlantic contributing writer, or a contributing editor for FT, the author of the fantastic book that I recommend everyone read, and I will link to it, Black Wave, if you really want to understand the modern Middle East, which was a top book for the New York Times in 2020. And she has been providing some invaluable insight into what's happening right now in Lebanon. And the big question I want to ask you, Kim, and I appreciate your time. I know how stressful it is. I know how exhausted you might be. I know how everyone wants your time, is as this war, Israel's war, is expanding now to the West Bank, to Syria, to Houthis in Yemen, and especially in Lebanon. The question I have for you is, how will Israel's expanding war fuel a new cycle of extremism and terrorism? And that, of course, there's an assumption in that question. If you disagree with me, let me know. But before we actually answer that question, I do want to ask you, how are you? How is your family?
Waj, it's great to be with you. I'm fine. I live in Beirut. I live very close to the southern suburbs, which have been pounded quite relentlessly over the last couple of weeks by Israeli airstrikes. Starting with that famous strike that killed the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah. Of course, southern Lebanon is also being pounded quite heavily. A couple of villages have already been razed to the ground, as far as we can tell from images. And yesterday evening, there was another strike, not to my south, but to my east, which was a little bit unexpected in a neighborhood where we did not expect that there would be any strikes, because we feel quite safe in my neighborhood, There's no Hezbollah presence here. I don't like to use the word strongholds, but the southern suburbs are a bastion of support for Hezbollah. There is a diversity of opinions there as well. There is a diversity of people, but it is a bastion of support, and that's what's been pounded mostly. But yesterday, the Israelis struck in three different locations, not in the southern suburbs, but in Beirut proper. And that is the result of people leaving the southern suburbs to flee to safety elsewhere, including members of Hezbollah, including those high up guys who are still alive, whom Israel then tracks to wherever they are. And one of them was targeted in that strike yesterday, in a neighborhood where he had, I guess, gone to find refuge. So the Lebanese feel very much stuck between Israel on the one hand and Hezbollah on the other, with neither one of them caring about the civilians that they're endangering. But how am I? I am, in disbelief that I don't mind revealing my age. At the age of 47, this is the umpteenth war that I'm going through. I've already been through Israeli war with Israel, invasion, etc. And it's just, it makes you ponder your life choices. What am I still doing here? Why don't I live, on a winery somewhere in New Zealand or something? But I also realize I'm very privileged. I have a roof over my head. I have options if I want to leave Beirut. I have options if I want to leave Lebanon. And I have the power of my word and my voice, which enables me to speak to people like you or give interviews to the international media or, be published, etc. And that is what, keeps me going. But there is, safety has become a very relative word because we just don't know, where the next target might be. Your nerves start to fray a little bit. I'm fairly zen. I'm mostly, again, I have to emphasize, I'm speaking from a very privileged position. I am mostly frustrated because I haven't been able to work properly over the last 2 weeks because it's very loud in Beirut. So I took a few days off. I went to the north to try to, get some sleep there. And then you come back home and you have to unpack your suitcase and then figure out what you have to do. And sort of you just feel like war is closing in. And you and your listeners might be interested in knowing that I've been working on a book for the last 2 years, my next book. And it is actually somehow by some, bizarre coincidence, it is the genesis of what we're seeing continue unfold today. I'm looking back at the 1980s, the Israeli invasion of 1982, the departure of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and the rise of Hezbollah, and looking at the arc of that trajectory over, the last 42 years, and here we are.
Here we are, unfortunately, and that book needs to come out yesterday, but it can't because you are stuck in the middle of a war, and so many people like you who are, have no fidelity or allegiance to Hezbollah or extremist groups or just people trying to live their lives cannot because they're stuck. And just some numbers, Kim, for people who don't know, this was yesterday, last night, CNN said up to 2.5 million people need, quote, urgent humanitarian food assistance in Lebanon as Israel's war with Hezbollah rages in the country, according to the United States Agency for International Development. Israel has pummeled Lebanon with an unprecedented airstrike campaign, killing more than 1,500 people, injuring more than 8,000, and displacing more than 1 million people, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. And that's in less than
That's
1.
a quarter of the population. A quarter of the population that has had to flee southern Lebanon, flee the southern suburbs, and just find refuge somewhere. So the state of the city, even Beirut, is, a mess because people are looking for a roof, people are looking for food. We have a country without a president, without a cabinet, barely functioning institutions, because we've been through 4 years of economic crisis, financial crisis, constitutional crisis. And it's just too much for this country to bear. So we're already host to 1 million Syrian refugees over the last 10 years. And now the city and its suburbs, northern suburbs and eastern suburbs and further up north, are having to host 1 million internally displaced Lebanese. And that's a huge weight on the government's capacities, whatever it has. Aid has been flowing in, and there is an incredible amount of solidarity from people, civil society, humanitarian organizations, you know, friends donating money, buying mattresses, providing their homes for shelter, cooking meals. This is how this country survives. But that's not a recipe for long-term stability.
But a lot of people haven't survived. And I want to stress real quick, you talk about how this has happened before. People are exhausted. In 82, Israel invaded Lebanon to weaken and destroy PLO. They say up to 15 to 20,000 people, mostly civilians, were killed. Ronald Reagan was so
correct.
Horrified by the images that he saw, he picked up the phone and told the then prime minister, knock it off. Israel...
He said specifically, I have a Holocaust on my TV screen.
He used the word
and Holocaust. Menachem Begin said, I think I know what a Holocaust is.
And then Reagan said, knock it off. And 20 minutes later, Begin called back and said, fine. Lebanon was occupied by Israel until 2000. There was
Southern Lebanon.
Southern Lebanon,
Lebanon
was.
Was occupied.
And then there was the 2006, battle, war, conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, which was essentially a stalemate, but left again a disproportionate number of people killed in Lebanon, civilians killed. And so now you have the situation appear again. And on October 8th, Netanyahu appealed to the people of Lebanon. And I want to quote him. He addressed the people of Lebanon using English and said, quote, you have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza, end quote. Your response?
Well, so at least he admits that, you know, there is suffering and destruction in Gaza. And that, you know, the Israeli military campaign caused that. Look, the Lebanese have very mixed feelings. People are really very torn. I would say that there's a solid majority of Lebanese that resents, hates, rejects Hezbollah. But being liberated by Israel is not on anybody's mind here. So you have a lot of people saying, you know, we're glad that that Hezbollah is being knocked down to size or, you know, clobbered, but we wish it weren't happening this way because now we're also suffering, right? But and that's where this is so different from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, because Hezbollah in Lebanon has become a very powerful political player that has a chokehold on Lebanese politics, that has a veto power on who gets elected president, that is armed to the teeth and has used its weapons against the Lebanese on the streets of Beirut in 2008, but also stands accused of having killed its political opponents, including the former Lebanese prime minister and many intellectuals and journalists, including friends of mine, over the last 20 years or so, since 2005. And Hezbollah was involved in the war in Syria on the side of Bashar al-Assad. So it has, frankly, it has more Arab blood on its hands than Israeli blood. And I think that that's where a lot of people in Lebanon are suddenly thinking, wait, we thought you were the resistance against Israel. What have you been doing all these years? And what is happening now? We're on the street. We've got no food. We've got no shelter. You said you would defend the country. You would defend us, especially the Shia community. And you failed. Now, again, going back to the message from Netanyahu, that was a very dangerous message. I don't think anybody in Lebanon is listening. Like I said, people may really dislike, be disappointed by Hezbollah, but nobody here is going to ride an Israeli military tank to victory against anyone else in Lebanon, right? That is not happening. This is not 1982, where the Israelis allied themselves with a right-wing Christian militia at the time, and thought at the time also that they could redraw the map of the Middle East. And we're hearing that same kind of language again today. We're going to redraw the map of the Middle East. You know what? It doesn't end well when the Israelis try to redraw the map of the Middle East, especially not with military force. So the message in Beirut, the message of Netanyahu was kind of dismissed with contempt. We don't need you. We're not listening to you. We don't believe you. Because the previous message was, our enemy is Hezbollah. It's not Lebanon. And the Lebanese are like, well, actually, we've seen what you've done to Gaza, and we don't believe anything you say, especially that we have been waking up in Beirut for the last 11 months or a year to the sound of to the voice of Israeli officials saying we're going to turn Lebanon into Gaza, we're going to annihilate it, Lebanon will cease to exist. Just 10 days ago, the Israeli Minister of Education said exactly that. Lebanon is all Hezbollah. It will be annihilated. Lebanon will cease to exist. And, I'm just waiting for Western officials to condemn the minister of a country calling for the annihilation of another country. Where is that condemnation? How is that acceptable? I mean, let's not even talk about what happened to Gaza. But now, because that's a whole episode, and you have covered that, and many people, probably not enough, actually, people have covered it, but not enough. But now we're actually talking about a sovereign country, right? Where you have the official, an Israeli official, Israeli minister saying, "We will, it will, Lebanon will cease to exist." And I just want to know, are these statements not being translated into English? Are we only hearing them here in Lebanon because they get translated into Arabic from Hebrew and picked up by the local media? Why is it acceptable for Israeli officials to call for the annihilation of another country? So,
We have an
yeah,
election.
long, long.
Kim, we have an election in 4 weeks. Can't touch this. This is a political bomb. Why touch it? Why actually exert our influence like Reagan did, like Eisenhower did in the past? Pick up the
Because
phone and stop
Democrats
it.
look at this differently. There is an election coming up, but there is an argument to be made for the fact that all-out war in the Middle East is not going to help Kamala Harris's chances.
No. And
So.
maybe she'll listen to you. I believe the expanding war, and this is the premise of the question today, will not bring about peace, will not bring about security, will not help Israel, will not help Kamala Harris. We've seen this story before. I'm so glad you're writing this book, is that in 82, when they went to take out PLO, there was no Hezbollah at that time. It was the attack and invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon by Israel that birthed, if you will, Hezbollah. So this time around, when Benjamin Netanyahu knows he has 5 weeks, now he has a month of carte blanche because no one's going to touch it, even though they should. And he has expanded the war to the West Bank. He's now bombing Syria. There's attacks with Houthis in Yemen, and now it's all-out war invasion in Lebanon. And like you mentioned, some of the genocidal members of his cabinet, they want to redraw the map, and they have some ambition in Lebanon. What makes them think, Kim, or what makes you think that this will turn out any different, that this will bring about security, that this incursion, this assault, this time it'll work, and this time there'll be peace in the Middle East, and by eliminating Hezbollah and this type of rampage and destruction in Gaza and Lebanon, which Biden has blessed, let's be honest about it, he could have stopped it, but he hasn't. This will bring about any different result than what we have seen over the past 40 years. What am I missing?
I can't speak for what the Israelis are thinking or why they think this is going to work this time. I can just tell you that it's not. Some factors are a little bit different from 1982. We don't have a cunning Hafez al-Assad sitting in Damascus. We have a rather bloodthirsty but also cowardly Bashar al-Assad sitting in Damascus, who's done, a rather not the right way to phrase it, but a rather good quote unquote job at killing his people for 10 years. But who doesn't really want to be involved in a war against Israel? So he's really, frankly, missing in action. But he's not as cunning as his father was at the time. As you see, in 1982, when Israel invaded, it was a tactical success in the sense that they kicked out the PLO. But long term, it was a strategic catastrophe because, as you said, it helped bring about the rise of Hezbollah, but specifically, it helped bring Iran to the Mediterranean. Because 2 days after the Israeli invasion, the Iranians sent a plane load of guys to come and fight in Lebanon. And Bashar, Hafez al-Assad at the time wasn't too keen on that because he'd been clobbered already by the Israelis and he didn't want to get into a full-on fight. And the Iranians were counting on Hafez al-Assad to provide the jets, the tanks, the field hospitals. And the Syrians said, "We don't think so." And so instead of launching into a full-on war against Israel from Lebanon, the Iranians chose to start something like Hezbollah. But there was a moment after the Israeli invasion where it did look as though the Israelis might have succeeded. And they were working on pushing through a peace deal between Israel and Lebanon that the US was trying to shepherd. But two things went terribly wrong. The newly elected president of Lebanon, Christian, and ally of the Israelis, was assassinated, most probably on orders of the Syrians, who did not want to see this new Middle East be born. And second, the Syrians had given their promise to George Shultz at the time that they would withdraw from Lebanon if the Israelis withdrew as well, because the Syrians were positioned in Lebanon as well at the time. But it took so long for American diplomacy to get this on track that by the time they were ready to say to the Syrians, "Okay, it's, you withdraw, the Israelis withdraw," the Syrians had changed their mind. They said, "No, actually, we're not, because we've got new weapons from the Soviets and we're ready to launch this anti-American, axis push against you with the Iran." I mean, they didn't say it like that to the Americans, but they said, "No, we're not withdrawing," because what they were doing was getting together with the Iranians to see how they could bloody the Americans in Lebanon, with some support from the Soviets, who wanted absolutely to make sure that America's plans in the Middle East with the Marines, with the peace agreement, that would fail. And they said very clearly to Lebanon's next president, who was elected after the one who was assassinated, that they would make sure the Americans would not leave intact from Lebanon. And it's just incredible to see some of those same forces at play today
Yeah, it's
with,
like Groundhog's Day.
Putin and the Iranians. Yeah, it's the same. But so, sorry, long answer to your question. Is it going to be suddenly different today? Are the Israelis going to succeed? I shudder at the idea that they might, because you cannot birth a region, a new type of region under, under the gun like this. It just doesn't work. It might not unfold exactly like it did in 1982, but trying again and again the same thing, right? As you say, the definition of insanity, trying the same thing and again, again and again, and expecting a different result. I just don't see it happen. But it is apparently also quite human to keep trying and expect a different result. I mean, it's not just the Israelis. I mean, various different people in history have tried this.
But what, the thing that no one has tried is ending an occupation, giving people freedom, giving
Yes,
people the right to
in this
self-determination.
case, yes, in this case, what gets forgotten in the conversation again and again, because we're all busy discussing the Israeli military campaign, is that the crux of this remains decades-long unjust occupation of the Palestinian people. And unless that is addressed, there is no long-term stability to be found in this region, because there will always be somebody fighting against occupation, because that's human as well, to resist occupation. And there will always also be somebody using that to their advantage, as the Iranians have done and as Hezbollah have done, to, you know, advance their own agenda. But whether it is destroying Hezbollah or destroying Hamas, unless you put forward a better idea and diplomacy, these groups cannot be destroyed. They can be diminished, decapitated, put on the back foot, etc., etc. But Hezbollah is also a political party in Lebanon. They have social services, hospitals, they're in parliament. You know, you cannot just destroy them.
My final quick question, because I know, Kim, you have to leave, and I know, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time, especially with what's been happening, is if you could talk directly to the Biden administration, because he still has power and he'll still be in power for a few months, and give him advice on what he should do. What would that advice be? Because right now, the calculation here is, well, green light to Bibi for the next month. Maybe they can weaken Iran, weaken Hezbollah, weaken Hamas, and we won't touch it for a month. And Kamala will win. And when she wins, then she can then rein in Bibi. We have a month. That seems to be the strategy right now. But if you were to offer him advice, what would it be?
I want to point out something, Waj, which is that other countries in the region are also looking to see Israel weaken Hezbollah and Iran.
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE, you know, even Egypt, I would think. I mean, so again, people are stuck between two very contradictory emotions. You know, I'm sure the Saudis are thinking we'd like the Israelis to, you know, cut Hezbollah to size, but we're also worried, because I'm sure the Iranians are telling them this goes too far. If the Israelis are going to hit Iran, you know, you might find some missiles heading your way as well. And I think that's a terribly complex set of factors to deal with. But I think the Biden administration should, first of all, push back very strongly, as they have, to be fair, this week, against statements like the one by Netanyahu saying we will turn Lebanon into Gaza. The White House and the State Department came out the next day and they said we will not accept Lebanon being turned into Gaza. Why it was acceptable to turn Gaza into rubble, you know, that again sort of, you know, boggles the mind. But let's at least, you know, not have a repeat of that. So it was good to hear them push back against that. It was good to hear them push back against Bibi trying to butt into Lebanese. It was good to hear them butt in against. It was good to hear them push back against Netanyahu butting into Lebanese politics. Leave the Lebanese politics to the Lebanese. You know, we make a mess of it, but it's our mess. We don't want anyone's, you know, any Israeli involvement here. I think the Biden administration needs to be acutely aware that communal tensions are going to start rising very quickly in Lebanon, because people are just overloaded. You have refugees sleeping on the streets. You have sectarian tensions starting a little bit. I'm not predicting a civil war. I'm just predicting, you know, just sort of friction, constant friction. People are, like I said, you know, sleeping on the floor, not enough resources. Everybody's crammed into the same space. There is a community, the Shia community, that is fearful, that is afraid, that feels that it's been robbed of a great leader for many of them. Not all of them, not all the Shias. Again, I don't want to generalize. Not all of them support Nasrallah, but a lot of them are fearful of what is their fate when they feel now, you know, unprotected, and the Lebanese state has never been there to protect anyone. And so it's time. It was time yesterday and the day before, but it is time now to start to press on the Israelis that they need to de-escalate very quickly. They've settled their scores. Hezbollah's on the back foot. They've decapitated the leadership. They're going to start getting bogged down in southern Lebanon because you know what Hezbollah is very good at? Guerrilla warfare, right? And we're already seeing the damage and the casualties that they're inflicting on the Israelis. And that is going to increase their capital again amongst parts of the population in Lebanon. So push back against, you know, statements like the one from Netanyahu, keep them far away from Lebanese politics, assist, regional countries to try to shepherd or cooperate with France and regional countries like they did when they tried to put forward a peace, a truce, a 21-day truce before all this blew up. And, you know, to the extent possible, understand that I think a generalized chaos in Lebanon and further military action by Israel in the region, in my opinion, my humble opinion, sitting in Beirut, is not going to do Kamala Harris any favors. So for the sake of the civilians who are dying and for your own, you know, electoral calculus, it's time to tell the Israelis in no uncertain terms, it's time to de-escalate. And the reason why I say de-escalate, not ceasefire, because I know how diplomacy works. We've seen this in 2006 in Lebanon. The Americans will not use the word ceasefire until the Israelis say we're ready for the ceasefire. Then the Americans will call it, and then they don't need to veto a resolution at the UN. Call me cynical, but that's just how it works.
And that's because you have seen this story before. And we have
Unfortunately.
Story for 40 years, and let's hope there's a new chapter with a new story. Kim, thank you so much for your time. You're doing fantastic work. I wish you and your family safety. As we leave, I always give an opportunity for my guests to shamelessly promote themselves. In addition to my shameless promotion, how can people support you? How can people follow you? Please let them know.
I'm on Twitter at Kim Ghattas. I tweet a bit. I don't post on social media very much anymore. I sort of, you know, sobered up on that. I find it personally just it eats too much of my time. Please buy my book. It's called Black Wave, and keep an eye out for the next one, which you know, will take still a little bit of time. And, you know, at this rate, I don't know when I'll finish writing it, but it's coming. I'm working on it.
The world needs it, Kim. Inshallah, we could. Inshallah, you have some safety.
I personally,
mind
selfishly,
to read it and write it.
Personally, selfishly need a ceasefire so I can finish this book. And we all need a ceasefire.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, everyone, for watching another episode of Chai Talk with Wajath Lee for the Left Hook Substack. And as always, stay safe and vote.
And next, Gideon Levy will explain how Israel has surrounded itself with shields. And Gideon Levy is a reporter and an analyst with Haaretz newspaper in Tel Aviv.
The Israeli society had surrounded itself with shields, with walls, not only physical walls, but also mental walls. I don't want to get into it because it's another lecture, but I'll just give the three principles which enable us Israelis to live so easily with this brutal reality. A, most of the Israelis, if not all of them, deeply believe that we are the chosen people. And if we are the chosen people, we have the right to do whatever we want. B, there were more brutal occupations in history. There were even longer occupations in history, even though the Israeli occupation gets to quite a nice record. But there was never in history an occupation in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. Not only the victim, the only victim around. This also enables any Israeli to live in peace because we are the victims. The other day, Professor Falk spoke about this dual strategy of Israel of being a victim on one hand and manipulating the other on the other hand, after what happened in Paris and in Copenhagen with the terror attacks, Benjamin Netanyahu came with the notion all the Jews must come to Israel. It's the safest place for the Jews in the world. It's a shelter for the Jews in the world, which is wrong because Israel is today the most dangerous place on earth for Jews. But let's put it aside. It was only 24 hours later when he said Israel is an existential threat under the Iranian bomb. And I asked myself, how can you dare call Jews to come and to join this suicidal project when the Iranians are going to bomb us? But in Israel, everything goes, and both declarations were accepted as the only truth. And here I get to the third set of values which enable us Israelis to live in peace with the occupation. And this is maybe the most crucial one and the worst one. We say victimization, we say chosen people. When I say victimization, it goes without saying we have to mention the Holocaust and the unforgettable Mrs. Golda Meir that the American jury had exported to Israel. She said once, this unforgettable woman, that after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. But the third set of values is the most dangerous one. And this is the systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians, which enable us Israelis to live in peace with everything. Because if they are not human beings like us, then there is not really a question of human rights. And if you scratch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find it there. Almost no one will treat the Palestinians as equal human beings like us. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations, rightly so. But by the end of the day, how many Israelis did ever try for a moment to put themselves in the place of the Palestinians for a moment, for one day? And I want to give you two examples which will demonstrate it. Many years ago, I interviewed then candidate for prime minister, Ehud Barak. And I asked him a question which I try to ask in any occasion. Mr. Barak, what would have happened if you would have been born Palestinian? And Barak gave me then the only honest answer he could give me. He said, I would have joined a terror organization. What else would have he done? Would he become a poet? He doesn't know to write poems. Would he become a pianist? He's quite a bad pianist, and I doubt if he would have become a collaborator because he is a fighter. And it became a scandal. Because how can you dare to put Ehud Barak to think what would have happened if he would have become a Palestinian? And the second incident, briefly, second intifada, the city of Jenin, the most closed city in the West Bank, real total siege. I go out from Jenin, I come to the checkpoint, a Palestinian ambulance is parking there with the red lights. I stand after him, no cars can get out of Jenin in those days, no cars can get in, and I wait. The soldiers are playing Begamon in the tent. Usually I know myself, it's better that I don't get into confrontation with the soldiers because it always ends up very badly. So I stayed in the car, but after 40 minutes I couldn't take it, and I went out to the car. From the car, I went first to the Palestinian ambulance driver and asked him, what's going on? He told me that's the routine. They let me wait 1 hour until they come and check the ambulance. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I went to the soldiers. It became a confrontation. But the question that I asked them, which really brought them to direct their weapons toward me, was one. What would have happened if your father would have been lying in this ambulance? This freaked them out. They lost control. How can I dare to compare between their father and the Palestinian in the ambulance? And this set of beliefs that they are not human beings like us, enable us Israelis to live in so much peace with those crimes, ongoing crime for so many years, with losing any kind of humanity, values. I heard today people talk about Jewish values. I must be frank with you, I don't know what are Jewish values. I know what are universal values. Let's not get into it, really.
So Zionists are to Judaism the same way in which the Ku Klux Klan are to Christianity?
Hi, I'm Max Blumenthal for The Real News. We're in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club for an event on the Israel lobby. And I'm here with Ilan Pape, Israeli revisionist scholar, I guess we could call you that. And you're coming out with two new books. And I just got a galley of your latest, which is called The Ten Myths of Israel.
That's right.
So what is the biggest myth about Israel? Would it be, a land for a people, without a land? Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, what do you think the biggest myth is?
I think it's very difficult to choose, and that's why
I didn't have it like a top 10 list.
I chose chronology as okay. The main regulator for the myth. So I began with the land without people and people without land. But I really think that the biggest myth of all, it has to do with how each of this myth does not allow us to understand the real nature of Zionism and the project of Zionism and the nature of Israel today.
Yeah, I think when you listen to Netanyahu, and he's sort of this master of expounding on this myth that Israel's not only not a settler colonial state, but that it's sort of a normal democracy that has flowered out of the Middle East almost organically because of the Jewish ancestral connection. And then when he talks about the conflict, or I wouldn't even call it a conflict, I'd call it a crisis. He always goes back to the Hebron riots. He goes back to these events that occurred before the State of Israel was founded, for example, attacks on Jewish communities in Jaffa, and never explains how those communities came there and what the real story was. So how do you challenge Netanyahu's narrative of Jewish-Arab relations in historic Palestine?
I think it's deeper than that. And Netanyahu, in this respect, represents a very deep Israeli-Jewish conviction that they are the indigenous people of Palestine, and the Palestinians are the settlers.
Yeah.
They are the aliens.
Yeah.
And this is the starting point. The starting point is we are the indigenous. Yes, we haven't been there for a few hundreds of maybe 2,000 years, but we are the indigenous people of Palestine. And from there, everything else emanates. And I think the way to challenge it is really by using this paradigm of settler colonialism, because it's not exceptional for a settler colonial movement to claim to be the indigenous people of the place that they occupy, colonize, and quite often genocide. It happened before in other places. And I think that's something that allows people who either were victims of other settler colonial projects or people who are part of settler colonial states like the United States,
right,
but are very familiar nowadays with their own history,
right,
and understand their own origins, to understand that actually it's not exceptional. It's not an exception. The only exceptional part of it is the denial, not the very historical act itself.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these myths are actually just Hasbara arguments by, in many cases, morons for the consumption of morons. But I found that in our world, there are a lot of, I mean, it falls on fertile soil. I mean, the education system isn't very good in the West. So you have these Netanyahu, and I think, you know, this is kind of a common feature of Hasbara, trying to draw a distinction between settler colonialism and traditional metropole colonialism. And you'll hear him say, you know, we're not the French colonizing Algeria. We have nowhere to go back to. You know, this is our homeland, and we can't go back anywhere. You know, how do you respond to that? And, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that we we've failed to do is explain how settler colonialism is in many ways more pernicious than traditional colonialism.
Absolutely. The exceptional part of the story is that settler colonialism made certain connections or made certain assumptions which were accepted in the 19th century but looked ridiculous, inhuman, and non-democratic in the 20th century. And yet, in the particular case of Israel, they still remain valid. For instance, the claim that the only way you can create a democracy in a country which has settlers and natives is if the settlers are always the majority, which is the argument of the liberal Zionists, not the right-wing Zionists. The liberal Zionists, the whole peace process is based on the idea that the only way democracy can be sustained in Palestine is if the Jews are a majority in their own homeland.
Right.
So this is a ridiculous assumption that in any other context would be rejected as racist, but in the case of Israel is accepted.
Right.
And I think that's where the interesting part of the analysis comes into, I think, and also in my book, in the 10 minutes, why educated, well-read people in the West did not see this? Or did they see it and decided to accept it for reasons of guilt, anti-Semitism, because they didn't want the Jews to stay in Europe? God knows why. Everyone had their own reasons for that. For the second point that you were making, I think that it's very important to highlight when you talk about any settler colonial project, what Patrick Wolf called the logic of the elimination of the native. That you cannot create a new settler colonial society or a settler nation state from the settler colonial's perspective as long as there is an indigenous native population there. So you have to get rid of them.
Genocide
them as you did in America, or impose apartheid and Bantustan on them as you did in South Africa, or ethnically cleanse them as you did in Palestine. The means vary from one historical case study to the other. The logic is the same logic. And what is amazing is that this logic is still legitimized in the 21st century in the case of Israel under the guise of slogans such as the only democracy in the Middle East, a country that wants peace but doesn't find the right partner for it, and all the other mythologies that are connected to the peace process.
Yeah, I think that the underlying logic of Zionism, of maintaining a demographic majority, a sort of ethnic overclass through violent demographic social engineering, is scarcely ever interrogated in our mainstream media. In academia, it's even very rare to see it. Would you say that has fueled the rhetoric and the politics of the far right in Western Europe and in the United States, where you hear someone like Stephen Bannon, who's the chief counselor to Donald Trump, the main intellectual force behind him, say at a major conference in Washington that the United States is not just an economy, it has to represent a culture?
We have wide and sometimes divergent opinions, but I think the center core of what we believe, that we're a nation with an economy, not an economy just in some global marketplace with open borders, but we are a nation with a culture and a reason for being.
And it's this culturalist narrative, which implies that the United States is white and Christian, and it must maintain a white Christian demographic majority. Do you think that has anything to do with the legitimization that Israel's experienced?
I do think so. I think if you are a member of a right-wing intellectual movement or ideological movement or political movement, you watch Israel desperately in a way. You say, my ideas, my assumptions, my discourse that is regarded as fringe, lunatic, and dangerous is welcomed when it is uttered by the spokespersons for the Israeli Jewish state or by Israel itself. It's exactly that. The dehumanization that Israel is allowed to express through its discourse, through its policies, through its activities is not different from any racist approach by any other group. In fact, settler colonialism is one of the most dangerous forms of modern racism. It's not surprising that the two ways in which Israel was trying to challenge this or protect this kind of exceptionalism, because it's very precarious. It can you know, one day the truth can be discovered and people would say, wait a minute, you're not different from an extreme right movement in America, you are the same, especially when the right wing in Israel becomes stronger. So there are two ways that trying to challenge it. One is by claiming that, oh, we don't use violent means. If you're a liberal Zionist, we're not looking for violent means of keeping demographic purity. We're actually willing to give up some territory in order to keep demographic purity, or we enclave, we incarcerate, right. We besiege the Palestinians in small Bantustan so that we will be demographically pure.
In Israel, it's liberals saying build the wall.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Liberal, of course, because this means I don't want to use supposedly violent means. I'm right. Not expelling people.
We're not going to transfer anyone.
Exactly. We're just not going to let them leave.
We're just going to say, it was Ehud Barak's campaign slogan.
Yeah, we are here and they are
us over
there.
Here, them over there. And we would recognize that here as sort of segregation.
Exactly.
But it's hard segregation.
Absolutely. And the second means by which they try to sort of hide it is the one that Netanyahu prefers, because he cannot say that he's willing to give up territory. And this is elevating this idea of elevating anti-Semitism into supposedly a new phenomenon,
right,
and the new anti-Semitism. And to say that when you criticize Israeli settler colonialism, you're not criticizing racism, but you're actually racist yourself. Like the indigenous issue. If the Palestinians claim that they are indigenous, we will claim that we are the indigenous and
right.
They are the settlers.
Right.
It's this really new speak.
Which
world.
Actually embraces the true logic of anti-Semitism that conflates Zionism with Jews and holds them responsible collectively for all of Zionism's crimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's above another layer of uniformity or connection between the idea that Jews should be settler colonialists in Asia or the Arab world and not live as communities in the West, which is another kind of joint platform for anti-Semitism and Zionism.
Right, which opens the door for this kind of alliance of convenience we've seen with parties like the National Front in France. The Jobbik Party even in Hungary is moving away from its traditional anti-Semitism into a more pro-Zionist. We see the Austrian Freedom Party, Strascha, was hosted by the Likud Party.
Absolutely.
This is a party founded by Nazis in Austria. He was hosted for a visit of the Holocaust Museum by the Likud Party. You go across the board to all these far-right parties down to Trump and the Republican Party, and they've all become pro-Israel. Well, holding on to this idea that, you know, Jews really belong somewhere else.
And this is the whole notion of the Palestinians as immigrants. You have immigrants in Holland.
Yeah.
And you have all the right to vote for a right-wing party because they are really Muslim immigrants and they create all the problem. We also have Muslim immigrants in Israel and they're using the same methods
right. To
identify themselves, to operate politically and violently against our own culture, our own set of values.
Right, we it's understand kind of, the terrorism that
absolutely.
You're experiencing. We have it ourselves.
And there are very worrying connections nowadays between the Israeli strategic advisors and experts and their counterparts in France, Britain, Holland, Denmark. They advise them how to control immigrant societies in order to preempt the next loner, you know, the next
lone wolf.
And
it's through biometrics and racial profiling and what do they call it, micro expressions.
And it's all built on this assumption we all have Muslim migrant societies that did not fit in to the host culture.
Right.
And that's quite a challenge for us to. It's so false. It's almost like the kind of Nazi propaganda that you have such a big lie that the bigger the lie is, the more difficult it is then to diffuse it. It's such a big lie that I think we are at the beginning we're a bit paralyzed when we try to challenge it because it's so false. And yet I think we have to be patient and unpack it again for the audiences and make sure that people understand how ridiculous and dangerous it is for both case studies.
Ilan Pappe, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm Max Blumenthal in Washington, D.C. for The Real News.